This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 38 was recorded on November 3rd, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. This week's featured interview guest is Willem Middelkoop, who manages the Commodity Discovery Hedge Fund, which Bloomberg recently featured as a top performer, up an astonishing 114% year-to-date. Willem and I will discuss his recent book, The Big Reset, in which he posits that the international monetary system needs to be reset so as to replace the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency, and his thesis for how the Chinese yuan will slowly gain favor as a central bank reserve asset, first through its inclusion in the SDR, and then eventually on its own. We'll also discuss why Willem thinks that we're at the beginning of a secular reflation in commodities, why precious metals have performed so well this year, and a host of other topics.
And I'm Aaron Chen. Before we even get to markets, I'd like to start with the election, since I guess so much has happened in the last week. And I know your views, Eric, on equities, gold, and the dollar will be strongly influenced by your views on the election situation. So why don't we get to that first? What's the update as we move into the final days of this circus of an election cycle?
Well, my first prediction is that this circus of an election cycle, it's not the final few days, because I think it's going to run into overtime. And I'll make a bold prediction. At this point, I think a clean, uncontested election, in other words, an election in which we wake up next Wednesday morning and it is clear beyond any doubt who the next president of the United States will be, I actually think that is now the outlier case that is extremely unlikely. My base case, which I think is almost certain, is somebody wins in the election, and that is then very hotly contested by the other side with myriad legal challenges. And the reason that I'm so convinced of that is if you look at what's happened in the last week, both sides of this have really good reason to object to either potential outcome. If you're a Hillary supporter, obviously this business about the FBI suddenly reopening this thing at the last minute, questions about whether or not the Hatch Act was violated by FBI Director Comey, who was acting in direct disobedience of, you know, managerial direction from the Department of Justice not to do this. Clearly, if you're on the Clinton side of this, you've got reason to say that, you know, Donald Trump was not going to win this thing until the FBI went and reopened this thing at the 11th hour, which is completely unprecedented. On the other hand, if you're on the Trump side of this and Hillary wins, you've got perfectly legitimate reason to say, hey, look, sure, the Project Veritas guy obviously has his own agenda. Maybe that video was edited or whatever other objection you want to make. But at the end of the day, there is overwhelmingly clear and compelling evidence that election manipulation, voter fraud, there's dead people voting. There is very clearly efforts that were put forth on behalf of the Hillary campaign, regardless of whether she was personally aware of it, that were intended to influence the election in illegal ways. So both sides of this have legitimate reason to be very upset. And I think where we are right now is a calm before the storm, because people on either side of this are kind of crossing their fingers, hoping that their candidate wins. What I think happens Wednesday morning, inevitably, is tens of millions of people are seriously pissed off because their outcome didn't happen. And there are legitimate reasons on both sides of this to say, hey, this is just not supposed to happen this way. It's already been reported that both campaigns are already amassing teams of lawyers in all of the key swing states to contest the output. The press made a big deal about how bad it was for Trump to not be willing to say he would accept any outcome of the election. I actually think that Hillary's side is more likely to make a big stink out of this, blaming Russian hackers and so forth. So the base case, I think, is a hotly contested legal debate similar to the 2000 election, where we don't really know what the final outcome is immediately. There are then extreme outliers, and they are outliers, but you could have crazy things happen here. Hillary could win by a landslide, but then be indicted on federal obstruction of justice charges, as the FBI has begun to intimate that they have evidence to support. On the other hand, if you want to look at this from the other direction, the polls could reverse by Monday afternoon to show that Trump is the shoo-in likely to win, and President Obama might actually invoke emergency executive powers that he doesn't actually have under the Constitution, but that's never stopped him before, and, you know, postpone the election until the Russian subversion claims can be investigated. Now, you know, Trump could win in the other direction again. Trump could win in a landslide, and then Comey could be indicted for violating the Hatch Act, and then Clinton could successfully demand a new vote. I'm not predicting any of these crazy scenarios. I'm not saying they're going to happen. What I'm saying is the fact that any of these crazy things are remotely plausible is terrifying. And all of these things are plausible, Aaron. This is an absolutely screwed up situation. Vladimir Putin offended a lot of people last week by saying, what is the U.S. a banana republic now? Look, forget that it was Putin. Forget that it came from him. Not living in the United States myself, I can tell you, the days where everybody else in the world felt resentment toward the United States that was all about envy and jealousy are gone. It's not about envy and jealousy anymore. I think that faith in the United States is being lost. Hillary made a big deal about, you know, a guy like Donald Trump with his personality should not have the nuclear launch codes. She then went to reveal state secrets that it takes 4 minutes for the president to give those codes and actually have the missiles be launched. Oopsie. So the question that the rest of the world is asking is, wait a minute, neither one of these people ought to be in charge of this incredibly powerful nation whose nuclear arsenal is you know, unmatchable. So I think that we really are on the edge of a dramatic upheaval in either direction, regardless of who wins. I think the other side is going to be very upset. I saw an article on Zero Hedge that there are actually armed militias forming, practicing their combat skills to get ready for the post-Hillary win upheaval. You know, people are going crazy. And I think anything is possible next week. So if anything, I think that this situation is worse than most people think.
Yeah, it's a hairy, spicy meatball for sure. Okay, so how does all this transfer for equity markets? I mean, in the last week, the S&P traded as high as 2130 and also as low as 2079 and closed Thursday session at 2083. So, Eric, what's going on here? What's the outlook?
I think equity markets are still underpricing outlier risk. And obviously, some of the things I said a minute ago are admittedly crazy. But you know what? They're not completely implausible. We could easily see all kinds of things happen here. If you want to know what's the catalyst that could bring about a 1987-sized crash, the answer is a major upset after the election. You know, it's either Hillary Clinton wins, president-elect Hillary Clinton is indicted on federal obstruction of justice charges, and you get into a whole question of you know, is it possible to impeach a president before they're even inaugurated? Or it could go in the other direction, where Trump wins in a landslide, and then the Clinton side successfully pushes the Hatch Act argument, and Comey is indicted, and Hillary's side gets some kind of decision for a rematch or a new vote. If we had a loss of faith where nobody knows who the next president of the United States is, anything could happen. And I don't think even the weakness that we've seen in the last few days in equities begins to do justice to that. So these are, again, outliers. I'm not predicting that they're going to happen, but the very fact that they're plausible is scary. When I saw on Tuesday morning that decisive breakdown below the February 11 trend line, the trend line that began on February 11th, so that was a move below about 2120, and particularly when we took out the FBI announcement lows, which was about 2114 or 2113, I ended up getting filled at 2111 on a short position on the S&P. And, you know, I could get stopped out of that. It could reverse very easily. But I think volatility is going to be the story moving forward. I am absolutely upset with myself. As soon as the FBI news came out on Friday, the first thought to hit my head was calls on VIX futures. And they had already spiked, and I didn't pull the trigger. And I'm so wanting to shoot myself because that was exactly the right trade. And I think probably the move is already in, but we could see VIX go to the moon from here. So anything's possible, and I expect heightened volatility into the election and after the election in probably several waves. You know, first it seems like there's a clear winner on Tuesday night, and then it's contested. And then whether or not the argument that it's being contested under is going to hold water or not gets answered by somebody, and then it comes back into question again, and then new evidence comes out, and then the FBI makes their next move. There could just be chapter after chapter of volatility as a result of this highly uncertain situation.
Absolutely. So let's move on to the U.S. dollar index. One of the biggest stories we've been following for the last few weeks now has been the DXY's upside breakout above key resistance at 97.50, where it stayed for quite a while, actually. But suddenly we're trading below that key level. So what happened there?
Well, yeah, we were up to a 99 handle briefly, and for sure, the proximal trigger that caused the dollar index to fall off a cliff was definitely the FBI announcement last Friday. If you look at the tape action, it's just very clear that that's what started the move. I was stopped out of my long position when we moved below 97.50, which, as you know, we've talked about as a critical level. So far, the low print has been 97.07 earlier on Thursday. As we're speaking around Thursday's close, looking at 97 spot 16, I think we're still headed lower from here. So the question is, why lower? Why is the dollar taking such a hit? I don't think it's because the market thinks a Trump win would be dollar bearish. I think it's because the uncertainty, or the chance rather, of an uncertain outcome where we don't know who the next president's going to be. That would be definitely dollar bearish, as there's a loss of confidence around the world in the U.S. political and financial system. So I think the dollar weakness is about the uncertainty risk, and I think that could get worse. So, you know, it's a question. I'm going to wait, and hopefully I think that the base case for why we've had a bullish view on the dollar is still there, but this could potentially be a retest all the way down to those cycle lows before it's over. It's a question of how long this uncertainty plays out. And as I said earlier, I think we're seeing just the beginning of the uncertainty in terms of what could happen in this election. So I'm out of the long dollar trade for now, and I'll be looking to re-enter it, but probably at a much lower entry point.
All right, well, on to crude oil. WTI reached new cycle highs 2 weeks ago, trading above $52 for the first time this year. I mean, you said you thought the rally was overdone and likely to reverse, and now on Thursday afternoon, as we're recording, we're trading on a 44 handle. So good call there, Eric. What's going on with crude and what comes next?
Yeah, 44 spot 37 was the intraday low so far. We're looking at 44 spot 61. Around the close. Well, what's happening? First of all, OPEC did not reach any decisive agreement at their informal meeting last weekend. Well, holy obvious outcome, Batman. Who could have seen that coming? Macro Voices listeners know. And, you know, of course, it's November 30th is the big meeting, but it's looking more and more like people are waking up to the fact that this agreement is not as certain as they thought. Nobody seems to be waking up to the fact that it was irrelevant to start with, because now we're seeing a downside action that started before inventory came out, just on OPEC uncertainty. But holy cow, when inventory came out, every expectation of every analyst was utterly crushed by an all-time series record of 14.4 million barrels added to national inventory. Those are mostly from imports. And so, you know, as much as it might be tempting to declare victory and say, okay, the view that Art Berman and I had back on Labor Day, it's finally being proven out. It's tempting to say that, but look, folks, I don't think that's what it is. I think that we had a whole bunch of tankers that were en route to the United States. Hurricane Matthew probably had a lot to do with why they didn't get here when they were supposed to. They all hit port at once, and now there's a whole bunch of inventory being dropped on, for the most part, Pad 3, the Gulf Coast. As tempting as it might be to say, okay, that reignites the whole argument for a storage crisis, look at Cushing, Oklahoma, the delivery point for the West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil Futures Contract, a build of only 89,000 barrels compared to 14.4 million nationwide. So this is all about inventory. I think it's delayed ships coming into port, and it is offset. We saw a drawdown in gasoline inventories of 2.2 million barrels, a distillate drawdown of 1.8 million barrels. So, you know, it definitely is helping prices move to the downside. I think they're headed into the low 40s, probably. But the idea that we're going to get back to a new low below 26, as Art and I thought might be possible back on Labor Day, I don't see that at this point. That uptrend, however, that started with the $26 low back in February, and if you draw from that low through its, I guess it's the 2nd or so of August is the next low, and then there's another low on the 19th of September. That trend line was very clearly and decisively broken to the downside. So we do have a new trend in play. How far does it go? The obvious support levels, 42.50, or so would be the next obvious support level, then 39 after that, and then probably no real obvious support level below 39 until you get all the way down to about 35, 45, 35, 50. So, you know, those are the potential levels. As far as what happens, I think whether or not we see a continuing trend towards inventory builds is going to be the real determinant of that. And I don't think, as huge as this was, that it's necessarily the beginning of a trend. I think it's more of an anomaly.
Well, Eric, all the while, gold has gained momentum to the upside, trading above 1,300 this week. How are you feeling on gold here?
Well, I think that the dollar weakness and election uncertainty is definitely what's driving this sudden strength. I'm definitely regretting missing my chance. I almost bought 1250, and I thought, nah, I'm going to wait for 1225. I think we still got lower to go, just because that breakdown from the descending triangle pattern looked so strong to me. It looks like I missed the bottom. So I did end up buying, starting to scale into a long position on gold. I got in at 1296 on Wednesday morning. And, you know, so far my trade is in the green here, as we're looking at 1304 as of the close, as we're speaking on Thursday. But, you know, I think this is likely to continue as long as that uncertainty that we talked about around the election continues. Once that's all resolved, it'll be interesting to see whether or not gold can hang on to its gains. So I'll be looking for any more weakness to scale in, though. And we can talk later on about the long gold, long dollar index trade. I definitely want to get into that position as the opportunities present themselves.
All right, and finally, 10-year Treasury yields are holding up in the mid-180s this week. Anything new for this outlook?
Yeah, actually back down to 181 as we're speaking now. And yeah, you know, we're seeing that strength in yields. More and more analysts are starting to predict that we've got inflation coming into the system, and that could mean a secular trend reversal, which would tend to confirm Jeff Gundlach's view on this. I'm on the sidelines. I haven't seen enough to really tell me decisively which way I want to be in this. I want to be short treasuries in the long haul when we get a return of inflation and a secular reversal in yields. I'm not convinced for sure that that's upon us yet, but it looks like it might be, so I'm waiting it out.
Thanks for the market update, Eric. Willem Middelkoop manages the top-performing commodity discovery hedge fund, which has received a lot of attention this year for its outstanding performance. Eric's interview with Mr. Middelkoop is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Willem Middelkoop. And Willem, I usually start these macro interviews talking about the U.S. dollar, but in your case, I think your view on the U.S. dollar is very tightly connected with a broader thesis, which you described in your latest book, The Big Reset. So why don't we start by just laying out for our listeners, what reset are we talking about? What needs to be reset? Why is there going to be a reset? What's the big picture? And from there, we can move into the U.S. dollar.
Yeah, great. Well, we have two major problems within our international monetary system. As you know, the current monetary system was set up in 1944 during the Bretton Woods Conference after the end of the Second World War. And in the Bretton Woods Conference, the US proposed to start a new phase in the international monetary system, in which the dollar would be the anchor for all international trade and would be the anchor for the international monetary system. They also proposed to set up the IMF and the World Bank. So it really was the start of the financial system like we all know it. In the last few years, especially since the start of the credit crisis, more and more people have pointed to the fact that the dollar as an anchor for the international monetary system is starting to get shaky, and especially the Chinese and the Russians have been very vocal about the need to find a new anchor to bring the international monetary system towards a new phase. So that's what I call a monetary reset. It doesn't mean that the banks will close down and we will see riots in the street, but we can change the monetary system, and it needs to change. And there's a second problem. We have too much debt into the system, so we need debt restructurings within especially the developed countries in the West, but also in Japan, and I think also within China. So debt restructurings are needed worldwide, and we need to find a new anchor for the international monetary system.
Okay, now that's a view that I've certainly thought quite a lot about, and it just begs a really important question, which is, as much as you make very persuasive arguments, the fact remains that so far right now, today, in 2016, we don't really have a viable alternative to the U.S. dollar as a world reserve currency, because there's no bond market deep and liquid enough to absorb central bank-sized capital flows other than the U.S. Treasury market. So how do you see us getting from where we are today to where I agree with you we have to get to someday, which is a viable alternative to the U.S. dollar?
Yeah, these changes don't happen in a few quarters or a few years. Changes within the international monetary system always take years and years and even decades. The U.S. was the largest economy already in 1870. It took 70 years before the U.S. dollar became the most important currency. So it can take a while. The Chinese have been quite clear that the SDR, the special drawing rights of the IMF, the currency basket of the IMF, should be used as a new world reserve currency. And it's quite clear that the IMF, the Chinese, together with the U.S., are working to upgrade the SDR so it can be used in the future when deep enough liquid bond markets and other parts of the system have been developed, so it can take over some of the roles of the U.S. dollar in the future. And I expect this to happen within the next decade. That serious changes will be made within the next decade. And by adding the renminbi into the currency basket of the IMF, into the SDR basket, October 1st this year, it's proof that, for me, it's proof that the IMF is serious in upgrading the SDR.
Okay, now as far as what this will mean to the U.S. dollar, the view that I used to have about this is, hey, with the ridiculous amount of debt and unfunded entitlements and everything else that the United States has done to weaken its financial position from being the biggest creditor nation in the world to the biggest debtor nation in the history of the world, I used to have a very bearish view on the U.S. dollar. But in the last year or two, I've come around to the view that probably, you know, there's so much trouble in Japan and Europe and China that probably the U.S. dollar benefits and eventually gets to some kind of blow-off top that we haven't gotten to yet before eventually that bearish view takes over. Would you agree with that view, or do you think the top is in and that it's downhill from here for the U.S. dollar?
No, I don't have a very bearish view on the value of the dollar. Because, like you explained, the dollar is needed, and as long as the dollar is still the main currency within this system, I don't expect a dollar collapse to happen anytime near. But we do have this huge debt overhang, and we all know that U.S. debts are growing towards $20 trillion, and I think that's also a reason why the U.S. needs the IMF and needs the SDR to get rid of part of this debt. And during my research, I just published a new chapter for my book, The Big Reset, a few months ago. It's open. You can find it on the internet. I can send you a link. And in this new chapter, I published some reports about the idea to use a substitution fund within the IMF. So countries like China can substitute their dollar holdings into SDR holdings. And by using this substitution fund, we can get rid of excess dollar debts without causing a crash of the US dollar. So I think that's the road we want to follow. And a substitution fund for US dollars has already been proposed in the early 1970s by the US. So it's an idea which has been on the table before.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on the inclusion of the Chinese yuan in the SDR? Obviously, part of this is kind of ceremonial. It's, okay, China's part of the club now. Is that it, or is there a structural change with the yuan in the SDR that is going to affect markets that results in a tradable strategy?
I think there are two important points to understand. The Chinese are very aware of the fact that the Chinese renminbi is not ready yet to be the world reserve currency. Chinese are very long-term thinkers, and I've been traveling to China quite a bit in the last few years, and I learned there that China wants to be the leading power in the world, let's say at 2040, 2045. At that time, it's 100 years ago that the Chinese revolution started. So the Chinese want to be in control not in 2020, not in 2025, but much, much, much later on. So the Chinese are trying to make the renminbi a full international reserve currency, and they know and they understand they need time to do that. And so they can use the SDR by being included into the SDR currency basket of the IMF. Now, the renminbi is added as a fifth currency after the dollar, the pound, the euro, and the yen. It's quite clear that the renminbi is now coming to the center stage of the international reserve currencies. But they need much more time to develop their own financial markets, to open up their markets, to make the renminbi fully convertible. So this phase should be seen as one of the steps which have to be taken before the Chinese can really upgrade their renminbi into a full world reserve currency.
So it sounds like your view is that China's strategy to eventually make the yuan itself a viable reserve currency is to first diversify the world's reserve currency from dollars to SDRs, which is a basket that includes both dollars and yuan. And basically, if they're both in the same basket, the more that the yuan starts to look like a stronger credit over a period of decades as opposed to the dollar, the more that people will prefer it, and eventually they take over effectively. Is that what you see on the horizon?
Yeah, and by doing this, the central banks can gradually increase their position in renminbi as being part of their financial reserves. And this solution by using the SDR, it's a great solution because the U.S. stays in the driver's seat because the main component of the SDR is still the U.S. dollar. So by using the SDR as a world reserve currency, and maybe we can even start trading oil in SDR, we still have a situation in which the dollar, in which the U.S. is in control. So this is a great opportunity for both China and even Russia and the U.S. To find a common solution to the current problems within the international monetary system.
Okay. So it sounds like this is a long-term strategy, and I definitely agree with you that China is very good at crafting long-term, multi-decade strategies. And what you say makes a lot of sense. I want to shift gears now.
Let me add one point, because I think that's important to understand. The Chinese are totally different from the Russians. The Russians are on a track of confrontation. And the Chinese are on a track of cooperation. The Chinese don't want any confrontation. But they've made it very clear to the US they can't accept the current dollar system for much longer. So adjustments have to be made. And these adjustments we've seen in the last few months being made within the IMF.
Okay. I'd like to shift gears now, because commodities in general have been just hammered for the last several years by deflation. But we're starting to see a reflationary trend in 2016. And I know you've been in the news yourself recently, because Bloomberg recently published a performance table where the Commodity Discovery Fund, the fund that you manage yourself, was actually the top performer year to date through September, up 114%. So congratulations on that outstanding performance. But you've talked about a global parabolic demand for commodities and looming supply shortages. That's obviously at odds with the trend of the last few years. So what happened? What changed? Why is the tide turning for commodities, and where do you see it going from here?
Well, we've had this large correction in commodity markets since 2011. Of course, the super cycle for commodities started around 2000, 2001. We've seen commodity prices increase quite a bit in this period. And this was linked by China being added into the World Trade Organization and the rise of China and the rise of Asia. Well, markets don't go up in straight lines, so sometimes you have corrections. This was a very deep correction. It coincided with the cooling off of the economy in China, but everybody was afraid for a hard landing in China. But so far, we haven't seen any hard landings. And when you look at the trade in commodities, and especially to the Chinese imports of commodities, copper imports have seen records. We've seen records of copper imports into China every year, 2013, 2014, 2015. So now investors are waking up and realizing that the cooling off of the Chinese economy is giving a slowing in the growth of demand for commodities. So the growth in demand for commodities in the last decade was 10, 11% in China. And now the demand growth for commodities is half, so that's 4 or 5%, but it's still extra demand yearly of 4 or 5%. And the commodity prices have declined quite a bit in the last few years. And we also came to the point in time, I've been warning about this for a number of years, that the first shortages and deficits would occur within commodity markets. And if you look at the current supply and demand figures, you can clearly see that we have production deficits, not only in gold and silver, but also in platinum, in palladium. We have production deficits in zinc, because quite a bit of zinc mines are closing down. And this is sending prices of zinc to multi-year highs, and we've seen increasing prices in the precious metals complex. And it is our understanding, based on our studies, that within the next few years, more and more commodities will be arriving at a point that production deficits will send the price much higher. And that's why we invest in those companies who are adding to their reserves at a very low valuation.
Let's stay on precious metals for a minute. If we go back to your Real Vision television interview from January of this year, I think anyone who followed your advice on precious metals and mining shares is probably pretty happy right now, because the performance has been really outstanding. So congratulations on that call. But almost a year has gone by, so let's get an update. You know, we had a correction, a breakdown that looked to me like maybe we were headed towards the low 1200s, but we only got to to 1243 was the low print, and as we're speaking on Wednesday morning, we're back up to 1305 now, so nice move above 1300 just this morning. Is the correction over? Is it all uphill from here? What do you see on the horizon for precious metals?
Just before this interview, just before this this call, we have been adding quite a bit to our precious metal positions just today, because I think now is a wonderful time to increase your positions. We were fully positioned at the first part of this year up until August. In August, we realized that markets were getting a little bit ahead of itself. Valuations were getting a bit stretched. So we loaded off quite a bit. And we have seen precious metal stocks giving back 50% of their gains year to date since the start of August. And our fund is down only 15% since the high in early August. So we have waited to see if this correction would be nearing its last phase. And I think the price actions we've seen since last Friday convinces me that we're very close to a real breakout in this short-term correction, which started in August. The index for unhedged gold mines, the UE index, has broken out yesterday on Monday. Today, we're on the verge of a breakout in silver stocks. So I think this correction is almost over. And then we had a wonderful technical correction, which brings us to a point that the strongest rally within this recovery of commodity stocks, and especially precious metal stocks, can and will start probably in Q4 this year. So we're on the verge of the start of a next leg up. That's our understanding. And this next leg up can take us until the middle of next year and really send up, especially precious metal stocks, up another 100% maybe, and even more.
Well, great minds think alike. Literally minutes before we started taping this interview, I bought gold futures myself. So I guess we're both on the same page with that. Something that caught me by surprise putting that trade on, though, I see this as a long-term trade. I didn't want to buy the Z6 contract, the December of 2016 contract. I decided to push out to next year's December expiry just because I expect to hold that position for a while. And boy, we're looking at almost a $20 contango over the course of a year, which is almost double what historically, at least to my recollection, we saw there. Why is the forward strip so steep in gold right now?
I think many people are aware of the strange situation in gold and silver markets. Of course, the takedown in the last few months was exaggerated because of the selling of a lot of paper gold. Many futures in gold were sold. I think many people are aware that given the current uncertainty, especially about the U.S. elections, is bringing many investors to the precious metals markets. For the first time in decades, we've seen insiders like Bill Gross and other institutional investors being very open and advising people to add gold to their portfolio. Kenneth Rogoff, the former chief economist of the IMF, has wrote a column in which he advised developing countries to add gold to their financial reserves. So I think we're entering an all new ball game in which even institutional investors who haven't been active into precious metals for a very long time are starting to move institutional money to these gold and silver markets. And these are very small markets. And we also have learned that the central banks of Switzerland and Norway, they both have a portfolio of gold and silver stocks of over $1 billion now. So central banks who can create as much money out of thin air as they like are using this money now to buy gold and silver stocks. So what more proof do you want where you have to hide?
Let's go back to your Real Vision television interview from January for a second. Something you said in that interview, I think, caught a few listeners and viewers by surprise, which is you said democracy is not the only form of government, and what's happening now is indicative of the failure of the West. Can you clarify what you meant by that and where you see it going from here?
Well, because I travel quite a bit to the Far East and to China, and I'm a student of history and a student of monetary history, and you know, I think you live in the U.S. and your history is 300-400 years, and the Chinese history is 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years. And in China, they never had democracy. And the Chinese, they is one of the only cultures which has survived over 5,000 years. So when the Chinese make remarks about our democracy, I tend to take it serious. And the Chinese always say, well, your leaders say that they do what you want and what you like, but we do what the people want and what the people like. We do what the people need. And of course, China is not perfect. And in China, if you're a critic of the regime, you know, you'll be punished very severely. But the personal freedom in China is wonderful. You know, the Chinese government allow their citizens to do almost anything as long as they don't have any criticism on their leadership. And I always have liked the Eastern and the Asian mentality, which is so different from Western mentality, also when it comes to food and medicines. And this has led me to start thinking and doubting about our Western democracy and the current fight in the U.S. over the leadership of the most powerful country is such a great example of the failure of democracy. And we have been given an insight by reading all those mails which were released by WikiLeaks coming from the elite in the U.S. And we're being fooled and we're being lied to, and more people are realizing that the current structure and the current democracy is failing, not only them but the country as a whole. And I think and that's what I mentioned during the interview in January, we're reaching a point that the Western and the American empire and U.S. hegemony, it's reaching a point that, like all large empires in the past, the empire is on the verge of breaking up, and this is a scary development. And we see revolutionary powers, and the success and the large support for Donald Trump and the large support for the Brexit vote are clearly examples of people being fed up with the current system.
Well, I think we're probably in agreement. I remain the biggest fan there is of a true democracy, but unfortunately, I don't think we've had one in the United States for a long time. And I think we have essentially fascism masquerading as democracy, where the government's policy is for sale to the highest bidder. And it's a very sad story that it's happening. But let's go ahead and move on and talk about central bank policy, because that affects markets so directly. A question that I've posed to quite a few guests is, you know, if you look at the situation of the last several years, whether you agree with it or not, central bankers have been able to prop asset markets up by essentially conjuring money out of thin air with quantitative easing. And my contention is they will continue to do that for as long as they can get away with it. And so the question that I think is so important is, okay, what is the event that will eventually tie their hands and prevent them from being able to continue propping up markets with freshly printed money. And the only thing I can come up with is eventually we'll get to runaway inflation. And when we get a runaway inflation situation, now suddenly they can't be so accommodative because that would exacerbate the inflation. Would you agree with that view? And what else can you think of that might tie their hands and bring an end to this regime of central bankers supporting asset markets through excessively accommodative monetary policy?
Well, I'm always surprised that these developments always take much longer and can go on much longer than you could envision, especially given the current monetary madness like we've seen in the last few years. You would think that this soon would be over. But don't forget, worldwide, we all use the same policies now. Central bankers from Japan, even China, Switzerland, Europe, the US, UK, we all use the same QE's system in which money is being created out of thin air. And a whole new generation of especially younger people is growing up with the idea that this is normal. And look, we don't have inflation. So what's wrong by just adding a little bit more oil on the fire? Because crisis also to be expected every once in a decade, you can expect that in the next crisis even more money will be created out of thin air. And only a few risks. The biggest risk is that the general public will lose confidence in fiat money. I don't see any signs of it. It's only a small part of investors and insiders who are starting to move from paper assets to real assets. And central bankers can always bring gold back to the system to bring back trust into the monetary system. You can make the SDR gold-backed by using all the gold reserves of the US, the EU, and China. To combine these gold reserves and use them to build a golden foundation under the SDR, and then trust will come back. Another risk for the system is, as you say, that inflation will come back. And I think we're on the verge of a new period in which inflation will start to increase. But like I said, central bankers can use some more tools in their unorthodox toolbox to stay in control a little longer. And the fact that worldwide the policies are so similar, all these countries will stay together, will join forces within the IMF to continue this game as long as possible. But there's always a risk of a large crash like we've seen in late 2008 after the fall of Lehman. But I think central bankers are very well aware of these possibilities. And when you can create unlimited amounts of fiat money, you can solve almost any crisis which can occur. So I'm not that pessimistic on the short term.
It sounds like we agree that in the short term, you know, who knows how long they can keep this going on. They've been successful printing money out of thin air and using it to prop up the economy, supposedly, and asset markets, assuredly. And who knows how long that could continue. But you've also spoken about the dynamics of history, demographics, and even revolution. And I guess the question in my mind is, if you look at whether it's all of the debt that has been created since 2008, China's credit expansion has been just massive. We've had, people talk about the deleveraging in the United States, but in reality, at least in nominal terms, the amount of debt has dramatically increased. Central bank balance sheets have increased. Government debt, $20 trillion in the United States now. We've had numerous guests on the program who have said, you know, it's not right away, it's not next week or even next year. But if you look at history, war is usually the inevitable outcome of insurmountable government debt. So do you think that that view is correct? Do you think that this eventually all leads to an impossible financial situation for the Western governments that brings about, you know, a major war? Or how would you see this eventually being resolved?
Well, I'm not a big fan of Donald Trump, but I sincerely hope that Hillary will not win the U.S. elections, because Hillary and her neocon friends can bring the U.S. Into a position that a military conflict with Russia is unavoidable. And I see this as one of the largest risks in the next few years. And we as investors are getting more and more defensive because we see this risk as being one of the larger problems which could occur in the next few years. I always have my hopes on China, because in China we have very sensible leadership, which is very stable at this moment. And the Chinese, they just want to trade with everybody else. They just want to see cooperation or confrontation. But we see America also bringing tension to Southeast Asia, and the situation regarding the South China Sea could even bring more tension between China and the U.S. So, yeah, a large conflict, a larger war is certainly one of the major risks, but I think we can get rid of debts by using organized debt restructurings. I think within the next 5 to 10 years, the IMF might take the initiative for a wave of debt restructuring. So debts are not that scary for me as most people see them, because debts can be, you can get rid of the debts from balance sheets by using a few financial engineering tricks.
And finally, I'd like to go back to the Clinton versus Trump presidential race. We ask all of our guests not to endorse, you know, their personal views, because our listeners didn't come here for that. But just to comment objectively, in the case of either outcome, Clinton or Trump winning the presidency, what would you see the intermediate, you know, short to intermediate term impacts on financial markets? And this week, I'm going to expand the question, because I think the game has changed here, which is not only what is the impact on markets if we have a Clinton or a Trump presidency, but I think there is a very plausible risk now that we have a contested election and potentially a period of several weeks where we don't know who won, and it's also possible that Hillary could win and then be indicted by the FBI. So what do you think these three scenarios of either Clinton, Trump, or we're not sure would mean for markets?
I think the most important part for me, and that's what we also play with in our fund, early this week we started to play volatility. So we expect volatility to increase quite a bit. It also started last night. When Trump will win the election, you could see huge volatility, even leading to a crash. And I think most investors are too complacent and are not fully prepared for the risks when election results will be seen as negative. So when Hillary will be chosen as next president, not too much will happen. I think gold will rise, because gold has been held in check and near 1300 in the weeks leading up to the elections. So gold wants to move higher. I think the commodity complex wants to move higher. There's a real risk on much higher volatility when Trump will be elected. And then you really have to start to position yourself in a real defensive way in the next few days, because things can get rough on financial markets.
And what do you think the impact and result would be if we had an inconclusive election where the election results are contested, or there's something else that results in the outcome being unclear for a period of weeks?
I don't expect this to happen, because this has happened in 2000. It will be very it would be very strange to have this happening again in 16 years. But I think when Hillary will win, and maybe Hillary, a lot can happen in the next few days. But when Hillary would win the election, I think a lot of uncertainty will stay, because the FBI will keep investigating the Clinton Foundation and Hillary Clinton and everything which has been going on about the missing emails. So you could end up into a situation where Hillary Clinton could become in a position where she gets really big troubles in her first year of presidency. So when we have a situation like this, we also have, I think, much more volatility and much more concerns in the market. And if you add to this picture the deteriorating situation in the American and world economy, I think investors are in for a few unpleasant surprises.
Okay. Well, thank you, Willem, for a fantastic interview. For our accredited investors in the audience who are able to invest in hedge funds, I'm sure that they can contact you to learn more about your commodity discovery fund. For the rest of the audience, the name of the book, of course, is The Big Reset. Is that available on Amazon, and where can people contact you?
It's still available on Amazon. People have to be aware that there's a revised edition. It has a little red note on top, the top right hand of the cover. So be aware you buy the revised edition. And I'm glad to send you the link with a free updated chapter about the latest developments.
Okay, we'll get that link in our research roundup email that will go out to our registered users at macrovoices.com. Thanks so much for a fantastic interview, Willem. Aaron Chan and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Well, Eric, that was an excellent interview, and I immediately want to jump to answering a question that we promised that we would answer last week. So we're going to get to Davy Nelson's multi-part question about the popular long dollar, long gold trade that you and others have spoken about on the program. Now, you've explained the thesis numerous times, but Davy wants to know some of the finer details surrounding this trade, such as in what currency denomination would you be going long gold? Also, do you view gold as a commodity play without the drawback of contango and storage costs of, say, something like corn?
Okay, well, let's start with the basic thesis for the trade. Why would you want to be long gold in the first place? And the reason is that governments around the world are all working to debase their currencies. It's a race to the bottom, as some people have called it, competitive devaluation. You can use whatever phrase you want, but governments around the world and fiat currency in general is weakening. The problem is when you buy gold futures, or if you are at least a U.S. person who has your assets denominated in U.S. dollars, when you buy gold in U.S. dollars, you have the problem that U.S. dollars themselves are likely to be the beneficiary of that same phenomenon, which is other currencies around the world weakening relative to gold for sure, but also relative to the U.S. dollar. And because gold is priced in U.S. dollars, you know, when the U.S. dollar is strong, it may not be weak for gold in terms of how gold performs against other currencies. But if the U.S. dollar is strong, which a lot of us expect it to be for a number of fundamental reasons that we've talked on previous episodes about, that means that gold is not going to fare too well when priced in dollars. So the combination of a long position in gold futures, or if you prefer a long position in a gold ETF like GLD, as well as a long position in the U.S. dollar, which would be in the futures market, in the DX futures contract, or if you wanted to do it in an ETF, you'd use something like UUP, which is the ETF that's long U.S. dollars. By being in both U.S. dollar long and a gold long at the same time, you're effectively hedging out the fact that gold is priced in U.S. dollars. So if those same things that we're expecting to make gold do well end up making the U.S. dollar do well, and that would sort of undermine or take away the benefit in terms of price appreciation of gold in U.S. dollars, even though it's appreciating against other currencies, having that long position against the dollar index hedges out that risk so that you can kind of win either way. And the scenario that we've talked about, Raul Paul and I discussed at some length, is you can certainly paint a case for why gold could go down here as priced in U.S. dollars. You can paint a case, as we're experiencing right now, why the dollar index could be weak. But the idea that they both trend lower at the same time, it's hard for me to think of any justification or explanation for why that would occur. So being long both of these assets that historically are inversely correlated actually makes sense here. They're serving as a hedge for each other, but we believe that there is an argument for both to move higher as both the U.S. dollar and gold move dramatically higher against other currencies in a flight to safety trade. So that's the rationale for why to do it. As far as the contango argument, I wouldn't say so much that it's a commodity play. It is essentially a currency play that's not trying to trade one currency against other fiat currencies, but it's trading currencies in general, all currencies, against something which is actually limited in its supply and has intrinsic value because of its scarcity. And finally, to address the contango aspect of the question, and let's just refresh our listeners who may not be familiar with that. Contango is the difference between the near-dated futures price and the longer-dated futures price. The reason you heard me ask Willem Middelkoop that question is I wanted to get his take on this, but I found it very interesting that the contango in gold futures in particular has steepened dramatically. In other words, the difference between the price for December of 16 futures and December of 17 futures, that 1 year contango, historically, at least, you know, off the top of my head, I think the average number is probably about $10. It's more like $20 right now. So why is it that there is a discount in the near term? Normally, that discount would have to do with storage costs. In this case, what you heard Willem Middelkoop describe is he thinks the reason is because people think the price is discounted right now and have an anticipation that the price is headed higher. He believes that's the reason. And there's a lot of argument in the futures business about whether or not there really is a discounting function about future expectations or if it's just interest rates and storage costs. But in this case, interest rates and storage costs don't explain a $20 contango over the course of 1 year. So I think Willem sees that as a bullish indication. I would tend to agree with him. And it means that markets probably are expecting higher gold prices in the future. Does that really mean if this is an alternative to a trade in corn or something? No, I think that the trade in soft commodities, as Raul Paul and I talked about recently, is a pretty good opportunity. And I think a long position in wheat, corn, and soybeans might be a good idea here, or it might be turning into a good idea in the next few months. But I don't think that this really is, this trade is a replacement for that.
All right. So, Eric, thanks for answering that question. Now, I want to pivot over to something that's more pertinent to the politics. Now, from a geopolitical perspective, you know, numerous scenarios that you described at the beginning of the show involves some greater socio-political instability in the United States, as we've seen with the Philippines pivoting towards China and Malaysia opting to purchase military naval vessels from China. I mean, do you see the 2040 timeline for China's ascendance as the world's monetary superpower as Willem describes it? Or do you think the socio-political instability in the United States will accelerate that timeline?
That's a fascinating question. I think we're kind of talking about two separate issues here. What Willem was talking about is China would love to have the yuan become a strategic global reserve currency. And there ain't no way that's going to happen now, and everybody knows it, because there simply is no yuan-denominated bond market that could even begin to absorb central bank-sized capital flows. So they've got a crawl, walk, run in order to get there. And when he talked about a 2040 timeline, I think he's talking about a 2040 timeline for the gradual replacement through growing the yuan's presence in the SDR, eventually increasing the size of the bond market, you know, what it would take to get to the point where the yuan, independent of other geopolitical events, could, from a monetary standpoint, ascend to be a contender for a global reserve currency. I think it's a separate question, though, which is, if things are falling apart in U.S. politics, and, you know, does that potentially increase the pace at which we get to a change of hegemonic power from the United States to other countries? You know, I think that that is entirely possible, but it's really coming from a different perspective, which is that whether Hillary Clinton is elected president and potentially picks a fight with Russia, and that potentially escalates to a major conflict, a scary statistic, something like 48% of Russian citizens believe there is serious risk of nuclear war breaking out as a result of a Hillary Clinton escalation with Russia. They're scared about this, and I frankly think we should be too. Meanwhile, if you go the other way, Donald Trump is elected. He's going to pick a trade war. It won't be a shooting war at first, but he's ready to pick a trade war with China, which I think is a huge mistake. And I think that could escalate and eventually become a shooting war. So I think that we do have a lot of rising geopolitical risk, but I really think the topic that Willem Middelkoop was talking about in this interview was a little bit different from that.
All right, well, that's all the time we've got for this week. Eric, anything you'd like to add before we close?
Just the usual, that we really appreciate your help, folks. Zero Hedge, I want to thank them again for picking up last week's interview with Hugh Hendry. That helped our download counts and listener counts. The most important thing, though, is that you register at macrovoices.com for your free account. Doesn't cost you anything. Gets you the free benefit of our research roundup email, which is a compendium of links to all the best free research and content that we could find on the internet each week. And again, when you register, that increases our number of registered users, particularly if you register as an accredited investor. That's the statistic that Aaron uses to entice all of these high-profile guests to agree to come be on the program as featured interview guests. So we really appreciate you taking just a couple of minutes to register. Aaron, let's tell them what we're going to get in this week's research roundup.
Yeah, also special thanks to ValueWalk for the coverage. So for this week, we've got the latest video from the recent Vanity Fair and New Establishment Summit, where Jim Chanos and Kyle Bass shared a stage to discuss their views on China and taking contrarian views. It's a great interplay between the micro and macro, and I think it's a must-watch interview for the listeners. Then we have Raul Paul of Real Vision TV, who shared an interesting infographic detailing the risks that hyperconnectivity posed to global stability. And this was inspired by Dee Smith's recent interview on Real Vision, and I highly recommend subscribers check that out. Finally, we're sharing a two-part series on the geopolitics of a reserve currency by Bill O'Grady at Confluence Management. You'll find all this and much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we've gotten and continue to welcome your suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For our listeners who write or blog about global markets and would like to share that content with our pro-finance community, shoot us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag, and we'll include it in our weekly distribution. If you haven't already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for the latest updates and interview releases. You can also follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend, and myself at _AaronChen_. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chen. Chat with you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.